This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you vape? If you don't know what I'm talking about, then you are not part of the e-cigarette revolution. Over the last decade, e-cigarette use has skyrocketed, especially among young people. They've been peddled as safer, smoke-free alternatives to combustible cigarettes and as a tool for helping longtime smokers eventually quit nicotine entirely. But how much can we say conclusively about the safety and promises of e-cigarettes? And what about their appeal to kids? There are literally thousands of fruity-flavored e-liquids, including mango, root beer, piña colada, and so on. Could vaping become a gateway to other kinds of tobacco products? New FDA rules announced earlier this month will prohibit sales to minors and require companies to disclose e-liquid ingredients. But is this regulation overly cautious or not cautious enough? My next guest discusses these questions and more as we talk about the science of vaping. And you can join our conversation, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Arunee Bhatnagar is a professor of medicine and a professor of microbiology and biochemistry at the University of Louisville. He chaired the American Heart Association's first report on the safety of e-cigarette products. He is principal investigator in developing the AHA's Tobacco Regulation and Addiction Center. Professor Bhatnagar, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me ask you about what exactly is the difference between an e-cigarette, how that works in comparison to conventional cigarettes?
So the main difference is that in conventional tobacco cigarettes, the tobacco is burned and then the nicotine is then transferred into the aerosol, whereas in e-cigarettes, there is no burning and there is a solution of a carrier, which is usually propylene glycol or glycerol, and that's heated, and that's how the nicotine is inhaled. So big difference.
So it's not actually a vapor, like it's called vaping.
No, the vapor is a misnomer. Vapor is something like a gas that turns into vapor. Scientifically, this is an aerosol, so it has both particles and gases.
Oh, and what do we know for sure about how safe all this is?
Unfortunately, not very much. There have been some studies for the last few years, but I think the picture is still unclear. We do not know to what level or to what extent these devices are safe.
Mm-hmm. So we don't know, for example, about our hearts. We know that cigarettes are bad for our hearts. What about these e-cigarettes?
Well, it's not very clear. I mean, we know that cigarettes are bad, and we know that there are certain constituents in cigarettes that are particularly bad. And because e-cigarettes are not combusted, so they don't generate any of the combustion products, mm-hmm. some expect that they would not be toxic at all. But it remains unclear what the things that are still remaining in e-cigarettes, particularly the particles that are generated in that aerosol, or the residual aldehydes that are generated, or the breakdown products of propylene glycol or glycerol, or the nicotine, any of these could be harmful, but we do not know to what extent they would be.
I don't think I knew that there were that many ingredients.
Yes, I mean, it varies from the device to device. You know, there are three total generations of e-cigarettes. They come to be like cigar-likes and tank types. So they are of different voltages and different sort of power. So there is a whole sort of science and art to it now. What? And the composition varies. So it's been very difficult for us scientists to be able to track down a specific device and say, has this toxicity and the others do not. So it's a sort of a moving target for us now.
You know, after many decades of advertising and listening to tobacco companies, we came to realize later that really a cigarette is just a means of delivering nicotine to you. It's a delivery system. So an e-cigarette is basically the same kind of thing.
Yes, and there has been this belief that nicotine by itself is not as particularly harmful, and that if you deliver it in a certain way which gets rid of the combustion products, then it might not do as much harm as nicotine with the presence of all the other 7,000 chemicals that are present in regular cigarettes. But since this, we do not know much even about cigarettes and which particular constituents or chemicals in that cause harm, we can't be sure whether most of them are gone or some of the remaining ones are still associated with residual toxicity.
What's your feeling about now all these different fruity flavors of e-cigarettes coming out?
So that's a real problem. So the e-cigarette companies have been claiming that they want to wean people off combustible products and put them onto safer e-cigarette products, and that they are doing it to decrease disease and morbidity and mortality in the world. But the problem is that they are at the same time making these e-cigarettes and flavors that would be quite at home at a birthday party of a third grader. So what are they trying to do? We think that the strategy is to recruit a new generation of nicotine addicts by enticing them with this variety of different flavors. And so the health care public, as well as the healthcare activists, are particularly concerned that this might be back to the 1960s, where the tobacco the companies are luring new addicts into their fold.
Mm-hmm. And the FDA released rules earlier this month that will prohibit the sale of e-cigarettes to minors and require manufacturers that to disclose their ingredients and practices. Do you think this is going to be good for public health?
Yeah, so the public health community has universally hailed this regulation as being something which was long awaited. In the time, in the last 2-3 years, there was a wild, wild west there. People were mixing their ingredients. Nobody knew what was in what device and how each device was being operated. There were no standards, and you could mix, you know, your own e-juice in your bathtub and sell it out in your vape shop. The FDA now would require, and it'll take 2 years before everything is put into place, it requires that people at least disclose what is in their products, as we do for any other thing that we eat or drink. So we think these are very sensible, useful, and timely regulations that were much needed. The flip side is that it would be a prohibitive cost, perhaps, on small businesses and vape shops, and maybe only the bigger manufacturing companies or even the big tobacco might be able to afford the information that FDA requests in order to meet the regulation. But there is absolutely no other way to have these products in the market without regulation.
Do you see e-cigarettes? I mean, the advertisers have been saying this is a way of getting people off of regular cigarettes, but you could flip this around and say this is a way of getting people, as e-cigarettes are a gateway to regular smoking.
Yes, so a couple of issues with that. There is some anecdotal evidence and some weak scientific evidence, but not rigorous sort of randomized control trials that have shown that they are indeed effective as cessation devices. That's one. The second is, in smokers as well, most people are using e-cigarettes and tobacco cigarettes together, so they are what we call indulging in dual use. And so it might, in the end, prolong nicotine addiction. Thirdly, yes, some people worry about e-cigarette use by young people. There are about almost 1 or 2% new high school students who have now tried e-cigarettes, and several of them are using e-cigarettes on a daily and a monthly basis. And so we are very concerned that we are fueling nicotine addiction in the society. And there is also some evidence, although some other people, fiercely contest against it, that it is a gateway drug.
E-cigarettes are being advertised as something you smoke anywhere at any time. And we do see that. We see people that they call vaping in airports, bars, other places that have not allowed cigarettes, regular cigarettes, in years. If that's allowed in there, is this going to sort of change our perception of how normal smoking is?
So there are two problems again with that. The first is that even though e-cigarettes don't contain secondhand smoke in the sense that they don't smolder, but the exhaled aerosol can be absorbed by a bystander and would deliver as much nicotine to the other person as if you were being exposed to a cigarette. So the nicotine exposure is similar. Yes, because the combustible products are lesser in e-cigarettes, that there would be less exposure to the person with combustion products. The second, perhaps most important point, and you really correctly pointed out, is that the gains in public health that we have made in anti-smoking campaign has been to denormalize smoking, to prevent it being as an acceptable behavior in public, even in movies and theaters in place, so that is something not we or our children see on a daily basis. Now, putting e-cigarettes back in place in public eye would, we fear, sort of renormalize smoking and would or could potentially erode all the public health gains we've made in the last 50 years.
Is it okay to ask someone to put out their e-cigarette?
Yes, I mean, e-cigarettes is not lit, so it cannot be put out if they stop inhaling it. Yes, and because it is in some sense a civil right issue, you don't want you don't want to be involuntarily exposed to a psychoactive drug, would you? So you have full right to say that you should not be exposed to this involuntarily.
You know, it took decades for us to figure out that cigarettes were as toxic as we now know them to be. How long is it going to take for us to really have a sense of how safe or dangerous e-cigarettes are?
Perhaps sooner than later, we have learned a lot from looking at the conventional cigarette toxicity. The FDA has started a huge program with the 14 research centers around the country. The American Heart Association Center that I co-direct is one of them. And we are trying vigorously to be able to come out with some useful information about their long-term toxicity. Mm-hmm. But it's going to take time, and we need to see how much disease is increased or decreased with the use of e-cigarettes.
Well, thank you for starting the conversation here with us.
Thank you very much for listening to me. Thanks.
You're welcome. Aruni Bhatnagar is a professor of medicine and a professor of microbiology and biochemistry at the University of Louisville, and he chaired the American Heart Association's first report on the safety of e-cigarette products. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a new study that challenges the prevailing opinion on Alzheimer's disease. This is amazing. It says an infection in your brain, or lots of infections, may play a role with why those plaques are formed. Stay with us. We'll talk about it right after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the hallmark symptoms of Alzheimer's disease is the plaque that piles up in the brain, the plaque that contains the protein amyloid beta. And for years, amyloid beta has been cast as a villain, the toxic junk that gums up the brain. But it turns out it's possible the protein may actually be trying to help us, because a new study out this week claims that amyloid beta may actually be a sort of a foot soldier in the immune system that traps and ensnares any bacteria or fungi that dare to invade the brain. It keeps them from doing more damage. But the side effect of this protection? Over time, as the protein builds up in response to those infectious insults, dementia may be the toxic side effect. That's the provocative theory, sure to kick off a lot of discussion in the Alzheimer's community, that my next guest published this week in the journal Science Translational Medicine, and it's been a long road to get there. Rob Moyer is a neurobiologist at Mass General Hospital, assistant professor at Harvard Med School. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I listen to your show all the time. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Rudy Tanzi is a professor of neurology at Harvard Med School and vice chair of neurology at Mass General. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Moyer, from what I understand, it was a struggle to get this paper published. Rejected 6 times without review?
Yeah, you could say the headwinds were hurricane force, I would say. But it has made it through, and the reception generally actually has been surprisingly positive. So we're very pleased about that.
And legend has it that you had your inspiration for this project one night at a bar.
Yes.
Come on, fess up. You can fess up. No one's listening, just you and me.
Well, it wasn't a bar so much. It was that every Friday we have an attitude adjustment hour.
And that's what I meant, actually.
Yeah, at the department. And I did indeed take a couple of Coronas and came across a peptide called LL37, and it struck me that these were very similar to a beta. Whether that would have happened without the Coronas, I'm not sure. But anyway,
inspiration.
History now.
Dr. Tansey, tell us what happens exactly when the amyloid beta sees an invader. Walk us through the process you observed in the paper.
Well, in this case, whether it's a bacteria or a fungus, as you said, or even a virus, the small protein that makes up the plaque, called A-beta, will start to clump up. And you need these clumps for it to work. And it's these clumps that are also toxic to nerve cells. And these clumps, we call oligomers, bind to the microbe and actually prevent it from binding to a cell, like a neuron. So first it prevents the adhesion. And then it actually, we say agglutinates. That means it clumps up the bacteria and the viruses into a big ball, kind of like when you're sweeping the floor and get everything to the dustpan. And then it forms a web, a trap, and it entombs it so it can't cause any harm and eventually kills it. So it's a classic mechanism by which antimicrobial peptides throughout the body do their work to protect us, except this time it's in the brain and it results in a plaque.
And you get too many of these disease-fighting plaques, and then you get Alzheimer's.
Yeah, so the idea is that, we had a paper a year or so ago on Alzheimer's in a dish where we recreated Alzheimer's in a Petri dish, a mini brain, so to speak. And there we could show for the first time when we made plaques from human nerve cells growing in a what's called a brain organoid that these plaques are sufficient to trigger the rest of the disease. They trigger these things called tangles that kill the nerve cells from inside, and they trigger inflammation. So that's the match that lights the fire. But in this case, it's meant to do it's meant to protect you, but in the end, it turns against you.
So these plaques too are very tough, and they have to be so that the bug won't crawl its way out. But the problem there is, of course, once it's formed, it's very hard for us to clear it as well.
Hmm. Okay. So you have an interesting theory. You've got it working in a Petri dish. What's the next step? How can you cut open one of these globs of plaque and look for a microbe inside and say, see, this is what we're talking about?
Yes, we can do that. And in fact, we've based on this study, we've just started what we're calling the Brain Microbiome Project with the funding body that actually enabled this work to happen, the Cure Alzheimer's Foundation. They've plunked down $500,000, and we are going to look at a whole bunch of brains from Alzheimer's disease and ordinary people and work out exactly what is living in there as you grow older.
So
the
you...
Cure Al-
yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, based in Boston, is a foundation that funds out-of-the-box projects like this. They funded Alzheimer's in a Dish. They funded this. And they've announced about $500,000 for the first brain microbiome project. So the idea would be look in young autopsy brains, aged ones, and Alzheimer's, and see what's sneaking in as we get older. Our immune system goes downhill, blood-brain barrier breaks up. And so see what's living inside it, not living, but what's entombed in those plaques. And if we get common culprits from hundreds of brains, then maybe there's a chance for primary prevention later on against those particular microbes.
Do you have any candidates for which microbes in particular might be most or more responsible?
There's actually quite a bit of data out there on this, and the one most closely linked are the herpes viruses. And, of course, they're almost ubiquitous. Herpes 1 is 90% of people by the time they're 5 years old. They're recurrent chronic infections. Subclinical for the most part. So it's a likely candidate, and it's popped up very often associated with Alzheimer's disease. And this is probably the likely, but not necessarily the only candidate. One of the things our study shows is that amyloid formation is not dependent on a specific pathogen. It's a generalized response. A-beta will do this whatever you throw at it. That means that it may not be a single pathogen that's involved in Alzheimer's disease. It could be a number of them. Spirochetes is a common pathogen.
Lyme disease.
Yeah, Lyme's disease. And Candida is also a common infection agent.
Chlamydia.
Chlamydia as well. And all of these things could be triggering this same inflammatory response mediated by A-beta that leads eventually to neurodegeneration.
Are you saying that if your hypothesis is correct, that you can prove that infection causes Alzheimer's in the brain?
Well, this isn't infection the way we normally think about it. It's not infection that's causing encephalitis or meningitis. This would be asymptomatic, no clinical symptoms. I mean, in the mouse study, when the bacteria were injected into the mouse brain, and these were Alzheimer's mice, they were only 4 weeks old, so they don't have any plaques yet. And overnight, they got plaques. But what was most striking to me was that one plaque that's quite big had one single bacterium in the middle. So you wouldn't need that much to sneak into the brain to trigger a whole plaque. So to say infection, you know, people think rampant growth of bacteria and viruses. You just need a few microbes to sneak in and start this process going, and you get a whole plaque with just one of them, at least in the mouse model that we used.
Well, then why don't all of us have Alzheimer's if it just takes infection by these viruses or whatever?
Well, we all have, after 40, we all have plaques. And those plaques start to cause the tangles and inflammation. It's just a matter then of your genetics and your lifestyle. I wrote extensively about this in a couple of books, Superbrain and Supergenes, about how lifestyle and genetics combines to determine your response to all of this. How do you respond to the plaques, and when do you finally succumb to dementia? So that's where genetics and lifestyle comes in as well.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Wanted to jump in there?
Rob?
It really also is probably a dose response effect, and there are some other factors involved. For instance, ApoE4 is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. Well, turns out it's also a risk factor for brain infections from a lot of different pathogens, which hitch a ride on it to get into your central nervous system. So there are a number of things that could be leading to cause the variation that you see in people's susceptibility to the disease.
That you're doing this microbiome project, which sounds really interesting for the brain. Could you uncover other diseases, not just in Alzheimer's, that might also be caused by? And why should this be the only thing?
Well, that's true. We may have come across an underlying theme for a number of diseases. There is about 30 amyloid diseases for people, and that includes some of the big diseases that we have, including diabetes, which is an amyloid disease. Actually, Alzheimer's is sometimes called diabetes type 3 because the parallels between the two are remarkable, which has been noted for over 50 years. But the underlying basis for that has not been clear. But there's a peptide called amylin that forms amyloid in the pancreas. And if it's doing the same thing that A-beta is doing, that has some pretty big implications for diabetes as well. And there are others. So,
Rob, also add that there are also several known antimicrobial peptides in the body that do cause amyloid diseases in the heart, in the eye, and in the seminal vesicles. So, you know, to some extent, for people who study antimicrobial peptides, what we're seeing in the brain isn't new to them. What's new is that it's defining perhaps how we get the first pathology of Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, the direction of this has been there are antimicrobial peptides that form amyloid diseases, but nobody has suggested that there's an amyloid protein that is an antimicrobial peptide. Until our stuff has come along anyway.
Yeah, you know, the skepticism about and the disbelief a little bit about this reminds me of when people discovered that H. pylori bacteria caused ulcers. I remember that. People said, you guys are crazy. You know, Barry Marshall actually infected himself with it to prove it, didn't he?
He was my old microbiology teacher, as it happens, back at West Australia. Yeah, I know.
That explains a lot, Rob.
It does, yeah.
I mean, was it a motivation? Now, very seriously, if he was a mentor of yours, does it give you less fear of striking out on your own with an interesting idea?
Yeah, it does. And his was a cautionary tale. I was among the skeptics. The rumor was at the time, I was an undergraduate, but the rumor was he kept his mice in his garage because he didn't have the money to put them in the animal house. And he was certainly, you know, considered a wild idea. But, you know, and it was. But it proved also to be correct. So, yeah, I think it does kind of give you a little bit of a perspective when you're close to something like that. So, yeah.
On the other hand, IBS seems to be gathering some interest because there was an editorial out last month in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease by nearly three dozen authors saying, yes, infection must play a role in the disease, whether it's herpes or chlamydia or whatever. And they were saying it's time to start devoting more funding to this infection hypothesis. Why haven't we been doing it?
Well, I think until now, the evidence was simply, hey, I found there's some herpes in the brain or chlamydia. And they didn't have a model for how that might be causing Alzheimer's. And some went as far as to say, oh, well, all this pathology you see doesn't matter. It's infection that does it. Our study, for the first time, merges the two. It says, yes, let's pay attention to these microbes that are accumulating in the brain as we age, but they're accumulating and they're causing amyloid to form, and the pathology is and the emergence of the pathology is related to the fact that they're getting into the brain. And until this point, they didn't really have a cogent hypothesis of how infection might be involved. Now we do, and you know, this is a high risk project, but you know, we're very lucky to have foundations like Cure Alzheimer's Fund who want the out-of-the-box stuff, you know, and we'll do more out-of-the-box stuff.
We will.
Let me just, before you continue, just let me get this break in here and remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Rob Moyer and Rudy Tanzi. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the other thing that has kind of held it up a bit is that in AD, you can find these bugs in Alzheimer's disease brain, quite often many Alzheimer's, but no single pathogen has been associated with 100% of Alzheimer's disease patients. And that's the kind of thing for most infectious diseases that people want to see. But our kind of model says, well, you don't need a single pathogen. You can have a whole bunch of different pathogens. It's the inflammatory response that A-beta mediates that's the problem.
Uh-huh. Well, what about if you prove the connection, how easy is it to treat it then with either antivirals, anti-inflammatory drugs, or drugs that clear the amyloid?
Well, right now, most of the therapies that we're waiting for readouts, hit the amyloid. So the idea is to clear amyloid. And many of the earlier therapies that tried to clear amyloid failed because they were treating full-blown patients, and the amyloid accumulates 10, 15, 20 years before symptoms. So it was like treating people who had heart attacks and congestive heart failure with statins for cholesterol. You had to do that 10 years ago. So now amyloid's being treated much earlier. We'll get those readouts over the next 4 years. But this would so that's called secondary prevention. You're trying to reduce the pathology. Primary prevention would be stop that pathology from occurring in the first place. If amyloid is being driven in most people by the slow accumulation of microbes in the brain, then we can think about active immunization. We can think about antivirals. We can think about new classes of antibiotics that get into the brain that Rob and I are working on. But first, we have to find out who the culprits are. I mean, our paper just said, yep, proof of concept. Amyloid's antimicrobial, and these microbes can rapidly seed the amyloid even overnight. But now we have to systematically study the brain from young to old to Alzheimer's and look into plaques and say what's living in there and who are our suspects, and then we can really do the hard studies.
But I would add that our path may be quite a bit easier now that we've got the paper out and guys like you are giving it airtime.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you've gotten some positive reception. I'm pleasantly surprised to see that you got some.
We are, too.
Yeah, we are, too.
You know, we were expecting the full Schopenhauer. You know, Schopenhauer said, with any new discovery, first it's ridiculed, then violently opposed, and then taken to be self-evident. So we seem to have skipped the ridicule part, which is nice.
We do, yeah. Well, there has been some pushback, but by and large it's been positive. So, yeah, delighted
well,
by that.
You know what they say, if you're successful, it will have many fathers and not an orphan. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, doctors, for taking time to talk with us. A very, very interesting conversation. Rob Moyer is neurobiologist at Mass General, and Rudy Tanzi is a professor of neurology at the Harvard Med School and vice chair of neurology at Mass General Hospital, really close by. Thank you. Have a great holiday weekend for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you.
You're
Have
welcome.
A great week.
And good luck with your work. We're going to take a break, and as you know, the saying there's an app for that. Well, we're going to tell you about an app that scientists created to tell you about the rumblings of the planet, how you can track earthquakes with an app right in your pocket there. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There is an app, you know, for just about everything. More apps are tapping into the sensors in your smartphone to measure your environment. You can track your daily footstep. You can monitor your heartbeat. Researchers have come up with an app to help you detect now earthquakes. Yes, there is an app for that now. And my next guest worked on developing this app. Richard Allen, director of the Seismological Laboratory, the famous UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, great to be with you.
The app is called MyShake, right? How does MyShake tell the difference between an earthquake and the equivalent of a seismological butt dial?
So as you said, the apps that we have on our phones, they already measure steps. They count whether you've walked upstairs, whether you're running, things like that. And the way that those apps work is they've determined what the vibrational profile is for those motions, for the steps. And so what we've done is we developed a classifier analysis that can recognize an earthquake type of shaking as opposed to all those other everyday types of shaking. And so when you download the app runs in the background and it watches for this earthquake type of shaking. And then when it sees it, it sends that information to our server.
Oh, so you get a list of all the earthquakes that people are sending you.
That's exactly right. So since we launched the app back in February, we have seismic data. We've recorded more than 120 earthquakes around the world since we rolled it out.
Well, and how sensitive, how small an earthquake can you get?
Well, when we planned the rollout, we were hoping, or we were expecting to be able to record earthquakes greater than about magnitude 5. Which is sort of, you know, kind of getting up there in terms of the shaking. But in fact, the app has been recording much smaller earthquakes. The smallest earthquake we've detected, we've triggered on, is actually a magnitude 2.5 earthquake in Southern California. So we've recorded some really quite small earthquakes. So we're very encouraged. It seems to be working very well.
Huh. It's not as sensitive as seismometers, right?
No, that's right. It's very important to recognize that these kinds of networks that we're developing now using smartphones, they are never going to replace what I think of as the traditional seismic network, the observation quality instrumentation. Those networks, they can record earthquakes on the other side of the globe. And so that's really important for the research that we're doing, also for understanding, you know, the damage that happens in big earthquakes. But our hope is that this new network, this MyShake network, with potentially, you know, in the future, maybe millions of sensors, we can really understand much more about the earthquake process, how the earthquake ruptures on the fault plane, the impact it has on the buildings, how our buildings vibrate in the earthquake, just by the virtue of the fact that we have so many more sensors now.
Hmm. So if the app can tell you when an earthquake is happening, don't you want to warn people before an earthquake happens? Can MyShake do anything for them?
Well, we're experimenting with that. That's certainly our hope. I mean, right now, this is the first version. We just sort of rolled out the first public version. And so right now, this is a citizen science project. So, you know, we want as many people as possible to download the app on their Android phones and run it around the world. So far, about 170,000 people have downloaded the app. And then we can be collecting this data. We can understand earthquake processes. So in that sense, it's very much a citizen science project right now. But our hope is that we can run this fast enough that we can also detect the earthquakes quickly enough and push warnings to people before they feel the shaking in the future. And of course, we're working on doing that using traditional seismic networks as well. So we think that MyShake can help make those systems perhaps faster and more accurate in places where there are high-quality sensors. However, the real value when it comes to early warning is the many other parts of the world that are earthquake-prone but have no seismic network whatsoever, but turns out often have millions of smartphones that we could use.
Mm. That's an idea. They all would all go off at the same time.
Right, exactly. So, for example, in Nepal, we had two significant damaging earthquakes in Nepal last year, and I like to joke with my colleagues. I've done my best to figure out how many seismometers there are in Nepal, and the best I can do is say that I think there's about 4, plus or minus about 6. So it's a very small number of traditional sensors, but the 6 million smartphones, the 600,000 smartphones in Kathmandu. So if we can harness those phones, rapidly detect the earthquake, we could potentially provide a warning in places like Nepal.
And the app's available on all the cell phone flavors?
It is not. Right now, the app is only available to Android users, so you can download it from the Google Play Store. If you just go to the Google Play Store and you type in MyShake, you can also go to the website myshake.berkeley.edu and get the app. So right now, it's just Android phones, and the reason is that there are actually many more Android phones around the world than there are iPhones. But of course, we want to have an iPhone version as well, and so we're currently working on that.
Yeah, maybe someone listening will help you out with that.
That would be great.
Fascinating. Thank you very much, Dr. Allen.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Richard Allen, director of the Seismological Laboratory at the University of California in Berkeley. Now for a musical test. Okay, here you go. Ready? What do these two songs have in common? Okay. Did you pick it up? What they have in common? No? No, it's not all these baby, baby, baby stuff that's in the song. Maybe a flair for the dramatic? That is a bit closer, but the correct answer is something called vocal fry. You've heard that creaky register when it comes to speech, but it is popping up in pop music too. Why are singers choosing the fry? And how might listeners perceive it? Well, my next guests looked exactly at that, and some of their ideas were presented this week at the meeting of the Acoustical Society of America. John Nix, Associate Professor of Voice and Vocal Pedagogy, or Pedagogy, at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Mackenzie Parrott is a vocology researcher at also University of Texas in San Antonio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
John, what sound are we listening for in that Britney Spears song? Where is the vocal fry?
So it's at the onset of the sound, so we're hearing that, kind of like Lurch used to sound when he would open the door on the Addams Family, he'd say, "You rang." So it's a very low frequency, below about 70 hertz sound.
And this is a musical technique that's sometimes used. What is happening in the throat? It's hard to make that sound. What's happening in your throat when you try to do that?
Sure. Well, you've got really low lung pressure, and you're using not a whole lot of airflow, and then your vocal folds are very close together, but they're very relatively short and lax, and the air just kind of bubbles through. Most of the time they're closed, but we just get these little bubbles, and it's not a high amplitude kind of sound.
Yeah.
That's basically what's going on down at the laryngeal level.
There's a lot of vocal fry in speech patterns. It's what you would call the Kardashian style of speaking.
Well, yeah, and typically in speech it occurs towards the end of a phrase. And some people use it as, it's a way of denoting, okay, I'm at the end of my thought. Mm. I just did it right there.
we're not adopting that.
But what's interesting is that the pop singers and the country singers are using it at the onset. You know, they're doing it at the beginning rather than at the end.
Hmm. You ran, Mackenzie, a small test to look at the expressively at music. We're going to play two clips from your test, and I want our listeners to listen closely and decide which one do you find more expressive?
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming?
Okay, that was clip number one. Let's try two.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming?
You could get the fry right there.
right on the onsets.
Yeah.
Our listeners, they weren't aware of what the factor was. So that was what was really interesting about the study, is that we played the clips in random order, and we had a female and a male singer. And so they were just asked to rate the expressivity of the performance on a scale. And we found some pretty interesting results.
Such as,
just in our small study, it seemed to be that the listeners rated the female's performance with vocal fry onsets as being more expressive as her performances without fry onsets. And it was the opposite in the case of the male singer. So they rated his performances that didn't have vocal fry onsets as being more expressive than his that did have the fry onsets.
Wow. Can you any idea why the difference?
That's a very interesting question. One thing we want to do is go back in and, in part, these were not identical performances, you know, so we had them sing the whole thing without the fry, and then we had them sing the whole thing with the fry. What we'd like to do, I think, to really make sure that they're identical performances is to, if we can, edit out the fry so that it's an absolutely identical performance. The male singer sings popular styles all the time. The female is actually just finished an undergrad degree in vocal performance and is an aspiring opera singer. So,
yeah, I don't think, is there much vocal fry in opera?
It's not something that you could hear over a symphony orchestra. So it's not something advantageous for an opera singer to do.
You tested, John, to see if vocal fry was used in other types of music, not just pop music. What did you find?
Well, what I did was looking at whether you could hear fry without amplification. And you really have a hard time once you get in a big hall and you're farther away. You might hear that there's a little glide up in the pitch, but you really don't hear that, you know, that gravelly, rough sound that we associate with vocal fry once you get farther away, and especially when you have accompanying instruments, that's really going to cover up the sound of it because it's such a low and not a very intense sound.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with the John Nix and Mackenzie Parrott, both from UT in San Antonio. What is the idea here for the artists in using the vocal fry? Do your tests show why they want to include it or why they should stay away from it in some cases?
Well, I'll let Mackenzie talk a little bit about what we want to do in the future, but we didn't ask them what it was that people found expressive. We just were simply asking them to rate on a 1 to 10 scale.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk a little bit about what we want to do in the future?
Sure. In the future, another interesting thing that we found in my study was there was a little bit of a generational gap between the young listeners and the older listeners and how they rated the expressivity. So we were kind of wanting to have a larger sample from different decades of different song styles and maybe see how the progression of vocal fry has increased, kind of like how it has in speech in popular music, because it seems like, you know, during the 70s and 80s, especially with female singers, you don't hear it quite as much as you do in music from the 90s and the 2000s. So we're going to look forward to studying this more in the future and having not only more male and female singers included in our study, but also music from different decades, and to see if there's a different correlation between whether maybe people prefer the kind of expression that was used, like when they were of the music when they were growing up, maybe something that's more popular today.
Well, speaking of different decades, vocal fry isn't new. Didn't Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday?
Right.
Use fry?
Yes, exactly. And that's one other area we're going to look at, is kind of historically go along and see if we can, you know, kind of find where it first started to appear. And immediately I was thinking Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday, you know, some of our legendary, you know, kind of blues singers from much earlier in the 20th century, let alone the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the male singers did not use it also.
Well, absolutely. In fact, Ruben, who's our engineer here, he was mentioning, you know, Barry White from back in the 70s, certainly low voices like
Absolutely.
That, Lou Rawls, people like that.
Especially it's all over country music with male singers.
Why country music more than other places? Any thoughts on that?
I'm not quite sure. You know, one of the things we were trying to nail down, and I think as we study this in the future, we may have people, you know, do an expressivity rating, and then what made you rate it this way? We were talking with a colleague who's a voice teacher out in Los Angeles, and she was mentioning, you know, people might use it to be sexy or to be angry. It's also, you know, maybe a way of portraying intimacy, or maybe that it's difficult to get these emotions out. You know, it's like, oh, it's hard for me to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard for me to ask this next question. It's hard to do. Is there any possibility that you're hurting your vocal cords by trying to do this too much?
Well, there's a good way and a bad way to do fry. The fry that's really low in pitch and loose in feel is a whole lot healthier than the pressed kind of doing it. You know, and on an overall level, I think if we think about our voices, kind of like when we go to work out, you know, we need to do cardio, we need to do strength training, we need to do flexibility. And with our voice, it's more important to use regularly our full range and intensity and expressive capacity and not just limit ourselves to, you know, kind of a narrow little band.
You know, when I try it, I come out like Grandpa Simpson more than anybody when I try to do that, so.
Yeah, that's more of the creak, I think, than the pressurized thing than rather like the low rumble fry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You just have to try talking like a Kardashian and then see what comes out of that.
Now I'm understanding. I get it now.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Mackenzie Parrott. And John Nix. Mackenzie Parrott is a vocology researcher at the University of Texas at San Antonio. John Nix, associate professor of voice and vocal pedagogy at University of Texas, San Antonio. I'll get these days. And you can try out our vocal fry test. You want to try it out yourself? The clips are up at our website at sciencefriday.com/fry. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. We've got also our whole series up on our website that Luke Raskin has produced. It's up there also for you to have a look at this week. Lots of stuff and educational materials up there for stuff for you and your kids to do over the weekend. It's holiday weekend, as I say. Have a safe one. We'll be right here back next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.